We can just let it flow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a perfect way to start. Welcome back to the show, Tamara. You are a friend of the podcast, longtime supporter. Thank you so much. You are one of our main correspondents in the region, unpaid and unaffiliated, of course. But introduce yourself to people who might not know who you are, who might have missed your previous episodes.
Okay. Hi, Sina. It's very good to be back on the pod. I have not been giving a lot of interviews, but I'm always willing to come back here. Yeah, my name is Tamara Nassar. I'm an associate editor of the Electronic Intifada, a US-based publication that focuses on Palestine and related issues in the region. And it's good to be back.
So, Tamara, we have been sort of flirting with this idea for an episode for a while. I don't know the title of this episode, but I'll kind of say that, like, I've been thinking a lot about Oslo. Like, it brought back a lot of memories of my sort of early political memories and TV memories, really, of the famous handshake on the White House lawn.
Ever since Harry Truman first recognized Israel, every American president, Democrat and Republican, has worked for peace between Israel and her neighbors. Now the efforts of all who have labored before us bring us to this moment, a moment when we dare to pledge what for so long seemed difficult even to imagine, that the security of the Israeli people will be reconciled with the hopes of the Palestinian people, and there will be more security and more hope for all. Today, the leadership of Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization will sign a declaration of principles on interim Palestinian self-government. It charts a course toward reconciliation between two peoples who have both known the bitterness of exile. Now both pledge to put old sorrows and antagonisms behind them and to work for a shared future shaped by the values of the Torah, the Quran, and the Bible.
Right. And the meaning of that and how it was, you know, it was the kind of like, I don't know, it was like a meme, a historical meme almost now to us. But I, you know, obviously Oslo, the name Oslo means a lot to Palestinians in the context of the Palestine question. And I thought today we should kind of think about Oslo, but through the framework of its sort of, it's, you know, living in its ruins, so to speak, like,
right.
And one figure and you know, the relationship to the PA, which is of course the creation of Oslo, and also a curious figure, Bassel Al-Arraj. You've written a lot about him. Electronic Intifada has published some of his writing. You have translated some of his writing. Mm-hmm. So kind of maybe triangulating those three things, because I think in, you know, to me those are related. They are part of a kind of interesting continuum that Palestinian politics and Palestinian history seem to be stuck in for going on three decades.
Correct. I mean, you said it perfectly that we are currently living in the ruins of the Oslo Accords, which were, to clarify to the listeners, a series of agreements that were signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and Israel in the 1990s, as they were brokered by the United States for the most part. And I mean, the child of Oslo, the Palestinian Authority, have been very relevant in recent weeks following the death of a prominent Palestinian activist in the Palestinian Authority's custody, Nizar Banat, on, I think it was during the last week of June, which have exposed more than ever the purpose of the PA's existence and the main really purpose of the Oslo Accords, which was to create a collaborationist class that bears the face of Palestinians, but acts essentially as an extension of Israel's hand or an extension of Israel's occupation of Palestinian land.
The United States is committed to ensuring that the people who are affected by this agreement will be made more secure by it, and to leading the world in marshaling the resources necessary to implement the difficult details that will make real the principles to which you commit yourselves today.
I think this is a crucial point to understand as to the as to why the Oslo Accords happened and what the purpose was. And in my opinion, they were very successful. For, you know, we always hear this point being, said by commentators and pundits that the Oslo Accords failed, and that's why we are in the rut that we are in. But it's important to understand that the Oslo Accords, for their purposes, were actually very successful. And what they effectively did was that they took this, you know, the PLO, which was a national liberation movement that Israel saw for a long time as an enemy and a threat, and they've successfully nullified and exorcised this revolutionary spirit out of the PLO and turned it through the Palestinian Authority into this like subcontractor of Israel's occupation regime. And, you know, what we saw during the past few weeks, the reaction of the death of Nizar Banat. So to explain to the listeners, Nizar Banat has been a longtime critic of the Palestinian Authority. He was even a candidate for the Palestinian legislative elections, which were set to take place in May, but were last minute canceled, very expectedly. And he was arrested by Palestinian Authority forces on June 24th, and he died in PA custody shortly after. And there's been a massive reaction over his death, which some human rights groups have even called killing because it happened in PA custody. It's not exactly clear yet, what medically killed him, but his arrest has been called violent even by the EU. There were apparent bruisings on his body, and it really exposed more than ever, I've been saying this, the purpose of the PA's existence, which is to act as Israel's foot soldiers in the occupied West Bank and to suppress Palestinian opposition and resistance, to help Israel maintain its occupation of the West Bank and quell any form of resistance to that. And, you know, Basil al-A'raj, who you mentioned, Sina, was a Palestinian intellectual and activist. It's really hard to describe him in just a few words. He was a writer, he was a pharmacist, he was an activist, he was a writer, he was a historian. And he was previously arrested by the Palestinian Authority and even held a hunger strike with fellow activists that were arrested alongside of him in the last few months before he was eventually killed by Israeli occupation forces. And he came to be known as the victim of the so-called security coordination between the Palestinian Authority and Israel because of the PA's apparent role in collaborating with Israel to capture him and kill him in March 2017. And notably, one of the activists that he was arrested alongside of, Haytham Siyaj, was arrested by the PA in recent days as he was protesting Nizar Banat's death, which we can, you know, talk about some more, but I went on a tangent.
No, that was really good, because I think people, like, if people are around my age, that scene of the White House lawn was sort of sold to us, and I imagine Palestinians the most, as this breakthrough, this kind of historical breakthrough. And of course, at the time, there were plenty of people who were against it. I mean, the most famous, obviously, or one of the most famous, is Edward Said, who called it the Palestinian Versailles, and talked about surrender. And also, in the background of all this is the calamitous results of the of Saddam's war on Kuwait, of the invasion of Kuwait, and the PLO's disastrous decision to support Saddam. So you have. This is an interesting sort of coalescence of forces, I guess, coming together of forces, of historical sort of opportunities to create this entity called the PA, which then, as you very correctly put it, has now become the main sort of subcontractor of Israel's occupation, at least in the West Bank, right? That's the interesting story of the development, is that because in 2005, the people of Gaza made a very different decision, right? And that set up, at least that's set up, but that sort of brings us, I think, to some kind of a situation where you have the war, the most recent war, of, well, Zionism is going to Zionist, right? Like, the Zionists are, if anything, sort of dedicated to their project.
The difficult details.
And the assumption of Oslo was that, okay, you can be dedicated to your project, but we can have some kind of autonomy. But that's a logical fallacy, right? Like, that's a contradiction. You're inside of a trap whereby the colonizer is negotiating with the colonizer the terms of its own colonization. I mean, in reality, that's what it played out. And so I guess sort of one thing that maybe we can kind of start thinking about is, what was so great about the PA? Like, that people got that, what was so great about autonomy? Was it like the sort of relative autonomy? And that's an important, I guess, that's an important way to sort of phrase it, because it is relative autonomy. It's not, it's Zionists, I think, at one of the major sort of people associated with the Oslo agreements, like early on, well, not Oslo agreements, but the sort of the creation of the PA and the sort of set of security relationships that were established, is that the Zionists called it self-rule, right? And they never called it a state. They never called it sovereignty, right? Self-rule. And if you think about like what self-rule could mean, it could mean a lot of things, right? That's like, self-rule is how a lot of, you know, ghettoized communities run, right? That there are powerful people inside of this powerless space, ostensibly with relationship to outside of that space, right? And so it's an interesting sort of thing to think about in the sense of the Palestinian question, is that it really has, I don't want to say shattered, but it has cracked in many profound ways from those decisions of the people in Tunis in the early 90s, and the consequences of that. And think about all the money that's flowed into certain parts of you know, the West Bank and Gaza and whatever during this time, because this was essentially, the deal was, I mean, this has come more, this developed more over the time, but essentially the West Bank was ended up being sort of ruled over by the same core elite from Arafat. I mean, I guess it's more complicated too, because in the middle of all this is the Second Intifada, right? Which was proof that Oslo didn't really accomplish anything.
Right. But I think what you said about autonomy here is very important, because it did accomplish, it's promoted the illusion of Palestinian autonomy and representation, so that this US-sponsored peace process between Israel and the PLO, which resulted in the Oslo Accords, can maintain. I mean, it's very important for there to be a dog and pony show, a charade of a peace process between the Palestinians, or however they are represented through this collaborationist class, and Israel, that is being supposedly brokered by the United States, and wherein they negotiate certain tunnels and roads and certain pieces of land, and reduce the Palestinian question of liberation into this minor back and forth about specifics and details. And all the while, Israel can continue entrenching its occupation in the West Bank and throughout historic Palestine.
I would be interested to also hear your own perspective, because from this is the generation of Palestinians of your generation are the children of Oslo, so to speak, right? Like, you, your memories of are, like, I guess based on your age, I'm just guessing, is that, like, this is the world that you've known. And the relationships to Zionism that these accords and the so-called peace process kind of codified, I would say, and resulted in the deepening of apartheid, the building of the apartheid wall, the further encroachment of the illegal settlements, the further dispossession of Palestinian land, the incessant kidnapping, right? Like if you think back, what is the situation now compared to the beginning of the first Intifada? Like, is it, like, I don't want to say worse, Because I don't know, it's hard to sort of judge things like temporally like that, but like, is it worse than it was back then in terms of, if you measure it in terms of loss of land, at least?
Well, I think that, you know, the age of Oslo, however we want to speak about it, has been radically altered. I mean, dare I say, during the May uprising. I think the May uprising has changed a lot of the features of what Palestinian resistance looks like today, because what effectively happened, I mean, okay, let's backtrack and explain to the listeners what exactly happened in 2006 and 2007 that resulted in this present day division between the Mahmoud Abbas Western backed Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian and political and resistance movement in Hamas in Gaza, which rules the interior of the Gaza Strip, which is Hamas. Because I think this is very important to explain the significance of why today looks the way it does. So in 2006, Hamas defeated Fatah in legislative elections. That's when the last legislative elections of the PA took place. And Hamas had its base, or its the majority of its support in the Gaza Strip. Fatah had a bigger presence in the occupied West Bank. But after Hamas won in the legislative elections of 2006, the Abbas Party, which is, you know, the Fatah Party, which was backed by Israel, the United States, certain Arab states, the European Union, did not allow Hamas to govern the Palestinian Authority, despite the fact that they effectively won the legislative elections. So instead, what the Fatah-aligned militias in Gaza did was they tried to remove Hamas from power by force with the support of the United States. What happened then is that Hamas moved against them preemptively and expelled Fatah forces with Mohammed Dahlan and others from Gaza. And this is what really resulted in this, like in the current division that we have today, where Abbas and his cronies rule. Of course, I say this mockingly, like they nominally control certain areas of the occupied West Bank while they collaborate with Israel on them. And then there you've got Hamas that rules the interior of the Gaza Strip with the minor military presence of other Palestinian resistance factions there. So this has been the equation for the past maybe 14, 15 years almost. And there hasn't really been a proper Palestinian elections since then. So even Mahmoud Abbas, who has been the leader of the Palestinian Authority since that time, you can say that he's effectively not elected because there hasn't been elections since then. He's been in power for 15 years. But this whole equation kind of changed during the uprising in May, when Hamas effectively reestablished itself as not only a defender of Palestinians in Gaza, but also a defender of Palestinians in Jerusalem who are resisting against Israeli colonization and encroachment in neighborhoods such as Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. So I don't think that it's entirely depressing to think about the contemporary effects of the Oslo Accords, because the Palestinian Authority has effectively taken its mask off during this uprising when Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza were collectively resisting Israel's crackdown on this uprising that wasn't only taking place in Gaza, but was taking place in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem, inside of 48 Palestine, historic Palestine, which is contemporary present-day Israel, defending Palestinians everywhere against Israeli aggression. And I think it's interesting to think about what the PA was doing during that time. And when you go back and look at the protests that were taking place in Ramallah, in Al Bire, in Nablus, Palestinian Authority forces were basically acting as the buffer between Palestinian protesters and Israeli settlers and soldiers. So they were effectively protecting settlers from Palestinians participating in the uprising. And this really, really brings out the essence of, or the primary role, again, of the Palestinian Authority. And allow me to go on this tangent because I don't think a lot of people understand this point, and I think it's crucial to remember that the Palestinian Authority's subordinate role, which is built into the Oslo Accords, under which the PA was born, is to effectively, when you really put it all on the table, protect Israeli soldiers and settlers. Palestinian forces are not allowed to arrest Israeli soldiers or Israeli settlers who attack Palestinians. Palestinian forces are only allowed to arrest other Palestinians, meaning if an Israeli soldier or an Israeli settler injures or kills a Palestinian, the Palestinian Authority has absolutely no authority to touch a hair on the head of an Israeli soldier or settler. They can only arrest other Palestinians. In practice, what this means is that the Palestinian Authority exists to police Palestinians on Israel's behalf and to protect Israel and its settlers, and with impunity, you know? And meanwhile, all the while, the Palestinian Authority collaborates with Israel on so-called security coordination in the name of supposed security and managing dissent and keeping quiet and keeping calm. And how do they do this? They do this by collaborating with Israel's domestic spying agency, the Shin Bet, and other Israeli colonial bodies, by giving them basically information about Palestinian, suspected activists or anyone who might engage in resistance, whether it's armed or otherwise, in the occupied West Bank.
I wonder the sort of meaning of this most recent uprising and this most recent war, and how, in the midst of all this for a month, did anybody ever, like, and again, this is like not a scientific way of thinking about it, but who cares? But like, did I ever see once a picture of Mahmoud Abbas during the recent war? Did he even say a word? Did he even stand up? Like, this is the ostensible leader of the Palestinian so-called nation. And this guy is as irrelevant. He sits there in his like little office. He has zero presence. And yeah, okay, fine. You can make the argument like, okay, I don't exist in Palestine. It's not part of my active life. Like, okay, maybe there are people over there who support Fatah, who have their allegiances. But it says something that like, that Hamas really stood for. And like, think of like Yahya Sinwar, like walking from his office, being like, you know where I am, come and kill me. Right? Like, and like that is a historic gesture he made. Given the context, if you understand all of what's happening, just the sheer force of Israeli colonization, and especially when you understand like the uneven nature of this fight, where you have a strip of land that's been besieged for technically 15 years, but over 70 years, and who are denied all of the sort of basic sort of elite weaponry that their enemy gets from around the world. Yeah, sure, they have like an Iranian-Syrian connection. Okay, but like in the end, those are not advanced weaponry and like compared to the Israelis. However, that proves to be meaningless because of what they accomplished, which was disrupting the Israeli way of life, disrupting the Israeli economy, disrupting their peace of mind, disrupting their sense of total powerful, like absolute power over them. Like there is that image of the beachgoers fleeing from the beach in the middle of the day, like when the sirens were sounding. And it's like, that says something about history. That says something about the nature of the Palestine question, how it's changed. And I agree, you're right, that it is more, it like, how do you want to put, I don't want to put this without sounding like a goof, but like, we are, like, Palestine liberation has never been as scary of a force for the Zionist as it is now, if we put it that way. And so in the midst of all this, we're also seeing a very strange thing happening whereby Gaza is ruled, you could say democratically, because those people were voted in, while the West Bank, the legitimate quote-unquote face of Palestinian nation state, whatever that nation state is, it's not a state, as we famously know, is just this pathetic collaboration in class, no different than the most recent Haitian guy ruling by decree from their offices, except there's a lot more money. There's a lot more collaboration. I guess the Zionists recognize the importance of the PA, which is, of course, why they help sustain it. It's important to have your colonizer doing some of the colonizing yourself in terms of controlling any serious resistance. So It really, I really do appreciate you kind of opening it up to this level, because I think it's important. Maybe we should shift gears and think a little bit about one figure, Bassel al-Arej. And
sure. Allow me to say one thing. I wanted to comment on something that you said, and then we'll move on to Bassel. But you know, one thing that's important to recognize, I mean, it's what makes Gaza such an incredible place. And you know, one of the reasons, and I always say this, I've said it before, I'll say it again. One of the reasons Gaza is besieged from the land, air, and sea is not because, you know, Hamas is democratically elected or whatever. I don't think democracy begins at, you know, on election day and ends there. I think it's a much more significant case in Gaza, which is that Palestinians in Gaza are the freest Palestinians on earth. And this is precisely why they are besieged. And it's precisely why they are forced to be in this cage where, you know, the Israelis keep a list of items that can come, you know, that are forbidden from coming in and out. And they regularly block Palestinians seeking medical care outside of Gaza from leaving, coming in. Entering and exiting Gaza is a whole ordeal that takes several days, if not weeks, if it even works. And that's precisely for the reason that we saw in May, which is that the Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza refuse to let Palestinians die in silence. And it's not really, it's the Palestinian resistance factions' purpose is not really to kill Israelis or injure Israelis in their homes. It's really not the purpose, and it's not. I don't support it. I don't think it's, you know, whatever. The idea, like you said, is to disrupt Israeli way of life. To say that we are not going to die in silence, and we are not going to let Palestinians in Jerusalem and the West Bank die in silence. For a figure like Mahmoud Abbas, I mean, it was kind of hilarious that at the end of when the ceasefire was established on May 21st, the Biden administration, I think it was Biden who called Mahmoud Abbas and spoke to him. And I thought that was very funny because, like, what does he have to do with anything?
He was, yeah, like, what's he going to say?
Like, what is, you know, who is he? he plays absolutely no role in anything that's going on. But this is precisely why he's useful. I mean, Mahmoud Abbas has called this collaboration with Israel's occupation and its occupation apparatus sacred. I mean, there's like video evidence of this. The video keeps getting taken down.
Yeah, that was the one thing he said during the whole thing that people quoted. That was the only blip of news that I got about him was him calling it sacred.
I mean, this video is actually from a few years back, but it's resurfaced because I don't know, it keeps getting taken down from YouTube. I have a copy of it. I think there are still copies of it online.
I can put it in this episode. Yeah, I'll put it in this episode for posterity.
Yeah, you should. You absolutely should. But التنسيق الأمني مقدس وسنستمر سواء اختلفنا في السياسة أو تفقنا. And you know, the only times that he actually tries to make himself relevant again is by threatening to suspend the security coordination with Israel, which is he does this likely to mollify Palestinian public opinion and to appease to a certain class. And there are certainly Palestinians who support Fatah, but there's also a divide within, you know, the party itself, because its military wing has been mostly irrelevant in the news cycle, but it does exist. It hasn't completely died down. And there's also those who, you know, certain families who adhere to the PA and this dominant political allegiance and get benefits from it. And there's also the Palestinian elite class, which benefits from having certain projects in the occupied West Bank in collaboration with Israel's occupation apparatus. Like, for example, Bashar al-Masri, who has this Palestinians call it a Palestinian settlement. It's like, it's this compound area called Rawabi. It's like a state-of-the-art mini city in the occupied West Bank that is a multi-million dollar project. He proudly says that it was built on a so-called, quote-unquote, like economy of peace, because he boasts of his business relations with Israeli counterparts, to the dismay, of course, to the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So you've got this comprador class that directly benefits from this occupation, and they have their own loyalties amongst one another. But but this is, you know, precisely what the Oslo Accords were trying to achieve, which is to transfer the burden, you know, Basil al-Araj, in the piece that, you know, to move gracefully to that topic, in a piece that he wrote that was published after his martyrdom, in a book called "I Found My Answers," which is like after a line from his will. In one of the pieces titled "Dismantle It and Let Them Fall," of course, talking about the dismantling of the Palestinian Authority and letting its leaders fall, he writes that, quote, "The Oslo Accords transferred all the burdens and duties of the occupation to the PLO without restoring any rights, making it the cheapest occupation in history. Let us get rid of these burdens, dismantle it, and let them fall."
I mean, yeah, this is the question of colonization, right? Like, this is like the brass tacks, like Frantz Fanon level question, which is like, what do you do to fight your colonizers? Some people don't fight, and some people do fight. And this is then the story of Zionism has been also one about
also
finding Palestinians who are willing to collaborate, who will sell them land, who will participate in security cooperation. This is the weird underside of that history of resistance and unity, is that you need to have it in the face of people who sell you out.
And in every history of liberation, every history of every anti-colonial movement has its, you know, collaborators and its traitors. And what Basil argues in this piece is that it's crucially important to not only clearly and articulately expose these collaborators, but also the first step of liberation is to dismantle this class completely, because it's the first thing, it's the first fighter, it's the lowest fighter that stands in the way of liberation, because they are really, this is what I mean when I say that the PA forces act as Israel's foot soldiers. They are the lowest and most dispensable soldiers that Israel has to fight Palestinian resistance. And it's precisely why they should be the first to fall on the way to liberation, because all they do is prolong this occupation. They act as an extension of it, and they fulfill Israel's interests on the ground in the areas that they nominally control.
I mean, yeah, that's maybe probably the next sort of phase of this conversation, is that thinking about what it means to be the subject of something called a PA, because there is this fiction out there that the PA is this infrastructure of a state. Now, one way that that's a true statement is the fact that part of what a state does is violence. And that's actually a key part of what it does, is that it's in that the legitimacy of that state is imbricated or based on, I don't know what you want to say, founded upon, that is the sole source of legitimate violence. Otherwise, you would have disorder, right? Like, otherwise, people could kill each other over pieces of bread, right? Like, this is the sort of basic political theory. And this is why the sort of very strange consequence of Oslo created this kind of historical Frankenstein's monster of sovereignty and political power, but also dispossession and basically akin to a kind of prison wardenship in the West Bank, is that this has created a new form of colonial subgovernance. And I think like we might look back on this era of the PA and wow, like they really got them to collaborate with their slow colonization. And at least some factions refused to be part of that and actively fought it, which, going back to the first half of our conversation, is really the accomplishment of this most recent intifada, this most recent uprising war. And this has been that this is a sort of extremely noteworthy and like powerful kind of pivot, I want to say. Right. I don't know about pivot. It's hard to, I don't know. I guess pivot, I hate these kind of metaphors about history because it kind of puts things in a linear dimension. But think about a figure like Basil Arej. So let's dive into a little bit. Interesting character. He's known as the educated martyr. Comes from a middle class background, right? Kind of relatively middle class. He's a voracious reader. His family, I think there's been a long interview with him, with his aunt, I believe. They weren't like he was educated in Egypt during the Second Intifada. What do you know about him? Maybe kind of give us a class into who this guy is.
So Basil al-Araj is a very interesting, really, figure to talk about because in many ways I think that a figure like Ghassan Kanafani had to exist in order for a figure like Basil al-Araj to be born, which is the idea that to be an intellectual is, in the Palestinian context and in any revolutionary context, is to be a fighter. That's why he's called the educated fighter or the educated martyr. Because despite being, you know, a pharmacist by trade and unaffiliated with any of the existing Palestinian factions, he was found with Marxist texts when he was martyred by Israeli occupation forces and so on. He was, at the end of the day, a fighter. And this is precisely, you know, what I think a lot of people misunderstand or don't really talk about when it comes to Ghassan Kanafani, is that despite being an artist and a writer and a novelist and even a writer of children's books, first and foremost, he was part of an organized national liberation movement. He was a fighter, and I think this is exactly why a figure like Basil al-Araj came to be known as the victim of security coordination between the PA and Israel, and also why he became this icon for Palestinians is that he provided an answer as to how really what it takes to be a Palestinian revolutionary and what it means to actually, you know, now when we talk about resistance, everything has become resistance. You know, like you can like draw a painting or whatever and like people will say that's resistance. But it's really important to understand, like, at the end of the day, what preserves someone's dignity is to not die in vain and to die for the things that you would to live for. You know, I think this is precisely what makes him an icon.
I mean, yeah, it's really true what you say about the word resistance. It's so cheap now. It's absolutely so cheapened. But like think of what resisting Zionism means. It means like your death. Like really, I mean, like they will come after you and kill anyone. I mean, Mohammed Deif has been, they've tried to assassinate him multiple times. Like, this is not an entity that respects its enemies in the sense that, oh, like we'll fight you one to one. No, we're going to come after you one by one and pluck you away from this earth in the hopes of making any future resistance less. Right, and that's been the Zionist mode of operation for a long time, at least that I've been following.
I mean, I tr- try not to, because when we use this language, liberals kind of smear it as this like glorification of martyrdom or glorification of death, and it's absolutely not the case. But it's very crucial to understand what it means to give not your death but your life to something so powerful as a liberation movement, and I think it deserves massive respect. And this is precisely, you know, I think what makes Al-A'raj such an important figure. I mean, when he was hiding in a shelter for the last few months before Israeli forces found him through security coordination with the PA and killed him. And I mean, his will is very powerful. I think we should read it at the end of this episode. But when he was found with his will, he was also found next to, like I mentioned earlier, books, you know, like Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci and Mahdi Amal, who's a Lebanese Marxist. This is someone, you know, Al-A'raj. He had a massive knowledge of Palestinian history. You could ask him about. I never knew him. I never knew him or spoke to him before his death. It's precisely his death that really made him such an icon and made me read and understand and investigate and research who he was as a person. But it was precisely this knowledge that he had of Palestinian history and general economic and class history in general that made him such an icon when he was eventually killed through the collaboration of the Palestinian traitors and the Israeli enemies. And this is, you know, really, this is just what I wanted to say about martyrdom, because I do think that liberals kind of, when we speak of martyrdom, they smear it as some kind of like glorification of death when it's completely the opposite. It's precisely that life is so valuable, and Israel treats Palestinian life as so dispensable that makes death as politically powerful as living.
Yeah, no, that's something that I've learned through the Iran-Iraq war, right? The Iranians call it the imposed war. And there is this very, I would say, cowardly and immature and simply unfair sort of vibe among Iranian liberals, Iranian diaspora, to not say anything good about the Islamic Republic because of their own issues. And like the idea that people, like normal Iranians, you know, normal actual people, get up and dying for something, dying to defend your country from invasion. I mean, that is like romantic nationalism at its core. Now, you could be a sort of urban, smart, sophisticated urban liberal and say, oh, nationalism is bad. But some people's nationalism is defensive. Some people's nationalism is for good, can be used for good, you know, in the sense that like some people use nationalism because they believe in something. For us living in settler colonial countries, what, I'm going to wave a maple leaf? Like, am I really going to do that? A symbol of genocide? For some, I mean, and other people, like, I mean, you know, whatever. This is not here to be a referendum on different countries. But there is this idea that violent resistance, and if we were to endorse it on this podcast, I could have problems on my hands. So I can't say go out and do violent resistance. That's not what I'm saying, because that's going to get you killed. And that's true for most places in the world. Like if I said to people, go out and shoot somebody, go out and shoot a cop, like that's illegal. Like that will get you killed, right? Like, and that's what some revolutions are. Like that's what they're violent. They're bloody. They're someone who's against the state taking on the state in that really important terrain of who owns the means of legitimate violence, right? And the case study of Basil Al-A'raj is who owns the means of Palestinian resistance? Is it a class of kleptocratic Fatah elders who have ruled by decree for a decade and a half, funded by nefarious Gulf countries who have their own investment in keeping up the status quo and also decorating their own political agendas with the garlands of the Palestine question? And so they collect these little elite figures and put their sponsor on them. To some people, they would say, obviously to Basil Al-A'raj, is that this is an illegitimate political authority and an illegitimate status, a political status quo that I don't endorse, that things are happening to my village, my town, that I can't resist using any other methods. And so there is absolutely what you're saying. It's true that there's this kind of childishness on the part of liberals who talk about resistance, who talk about decolonization, who love to throw words around, right? Who have posters of, you know, Audre Lorde on their office doors, right? But, or Nelson Mandela, for God's sakes. But it's like, yeah, at a certain point, power intersects with other with resistance to power, and power kills. So is your resistance going to kill it back? Like, is that what that means to some people? And to some people that means yes. And that means you're going to receive the force of that power. And this is what we call martyrdom, right? I mean, at least in the Palestine context.
Exactly. And I think you make a good point. You know, the idea here is that liberals and academics, more specifically, like academic liberals, prefer to investigate like anti-colonial resistance in a strictly historical perspective. They don't really want to talk about contemporary resistance to contemporary colonization. They only want to talk about it as an issue of the past. And they are not willing to defend the right of people resisting by any means possible at their disposal against a brutal occupier that is backed by the world's, you know, worst empire. it's important to also recognize that a colonized nation and a colonized people like Palestinians, by definition, cannot initiate violence. They cannot initiate violence because violence is always already initiated against them by a brutal occupier with violence as its only language. I mean, Palestinians are living in a constant state of colonial violence by Israel. And as soon as they respond, as soon as they fight back, as soon as they decide that they don't want to die in silence, and use whatever means they have at their disposal to fight against this occupier, you see the EU and all of these, you know, liberal pundits and certain Gulf regimes condemn how, you know, the means that Palestinians use to defend themselves. But it's really, really important to reiterate and make this point stick that every time Palestinians, and this is, you know, Greg Shupak writes about this in his book, The Wrong Story, every time that Palestinians use violence against an occupier, they are engaging in self-defense. Israel, by definition, can never engage in self-defense because it's always already the initiator of all violence. It's like I think my editor, the director of Electronic Intifada, has used this metaphor before, that it's akin to a thief walking into your house and pointing a gun to your head and you killing them with a knife. I mean, the thief has no right to self-defense because they're coming to kill you. They're coming to take over your house and steal your stuff. But you are who is sitting in your own home and dealing with this foreign thief that is coming to hurt you and to injure you and to possibly kill you and to take your stuff, you're defending yourself. And this is, you know, this is really what I have to say about this form of resistance.
You have this strange situation where the Zionists have every opportunity, every advantage on their side, right? Like, not only forget like, you know, arms industry, all of that, but like they have an entire media apparatus that serves their interests, that raises money for them. I'm thinking of just one example from 2018, Pharrell singing Happy to the Friends of the IDF benefit, helping raise $60 million.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's one evening, right? One evening in Zionist history resulted in that. Now, okay, maybe the huge amount of money came from probably one asshole. Who knows? A lot of that stuff is for laundering. A lot of that stuff is for shit that we don't see that happens behind the scenes. So how significant is it? But whatever. But we're talking about $60 million in one evening. And people in the Palestinian like elite are sitting there fretting over Iran's influence. Like, you really have to be that dumb to think that a tiny amount of support relative to what the enemy receives from the entire world, right, is somehow some critical thing. I mean, that's the insanity. I mean, it's true that the weird discursive hostage scenario that Palestinians always find themselves in, which is like, oh, I have a gun to your head. Now say something about how it's offensive for me to be, how I feel endangered, right? Like, right. That's like the weird, absurd lengths
to which
time.
It's really a pathology. Yeah, it's like a complete projection. It's a complete projection. And this is, I mean, how they say in like the psychoanalysis that masochists are always like the worst sadists, and it's precise. Like I think this like applies to Israel in a very pathological, like bizarre way, in the sense that Israel is really the happiest when Hamas is firing rockets at it, because it gives it this like this leverage to hit Gaza even harder. Do you understand what I mean?
And yeah.
So it's totally true. But what you were talking about Iran as a country that Israel sees as a regional counterweight to its domination in the region. Recently, what Israel has been doing, and you know, in regards to Lebanon, has been really interesting. You know, Lebanon has been at the has been going through like a very deep economic crisis that's almost unprecedented. You could say, like, if you look at pictures from Lebanon, you see, you know, motorists like line up outside patrol stations and like massive lines as there's like a massive fuel shortage in the country, et cetera, et cetera. What's I think a lot of people missed this, but last week, Israeli Defense Minister Benny Gantz sent out a series of tweets basically saying that Israel was, quote, ready to act, and that he like made his offer to send aid, like send humanitarian aid to Lebanon through Israeli army liaisons. And the irony here is completely breathtaking. I mean, Israel is the destroyer of Lebanon. It has inflicted massive damage on the country. It has killed thousands of Lebanese and Palestinian civilians throughout the years. Israel still almost daily flies unmanned drones over southern Lebanese territory and over even the capital, Beirut, to basically whitewash its crimes. It's like its massive list of crimes against Lebanon. They're offering humanitarian aid. And of course, they did this last August after the massive port explosion that devastated many parts of Beirut. They also offered so-called humanitarian aid to Lebanon. But I mean, the whole reason that they do this is precisely because they are trying to counter what they view. I mean, Gantz did not even try to hide his political motive behind this like so-called humanitarian offer to Lebanon. It's really, he said, I have to like find this tweet, but okay. He says that it's really spurred by, quote, Hezbollah's attempts to deepen Iranian investment in the country. So really, it's not really about like offering humanitarian aid or whatever other nonsense that they're trying to clothe it with. It's really just to counter what Israel sees as an enemy in the region, as a counterweight to its domination.
I mean, yeah, like this is the thing is like what I said earlier about like, and I guess this is the perverse, I mean, unfortunately, the perverse vicissitudes of history have brought the situation whereby Palestinian politics, and I want to say even identity, maybe not, that's too strong of a word, is in direct relation to Zionism now. The Zionists need Palestinians for their own project, not only to sort of build up a country for them that they will steal, but also in the sense that like they need their economic force, right? They need their laboring force. They need that sense of victimhood spiritually. They need them as a political entity so that they can create some kind of internal enemy class, right?
So that the hardcore
base of Zionism that has always been the base of Zionism will stay within the ranks of, you know, revisionist Likud Zionism or whatever, right? Like, and think about like the fact that like Zionism needs to keep expanding, but the technical development of weaponry and rocketry and the equaling of the deterrence formula, which Israel has never had to face, right? They've always outmatched their enemies, always, because of their outside help. Well, in the sense that, like, I mean, I'm going to do an episode soon about this with Ziad, but he has this kind of, he wants to explain to me why the 48 war was they were bound to win the 48 war because of the condition.
Okay.
Right? And the sense of underdevelopment. And so the sense of, like, history is catching up to Zionism. And we saw that happen in the recent war, right? Like, they have, how much of their trade comes in by boat? Like, what would happen if one of their main ports went out? Like, how long could they survive? Like, what the weak roots, the shallow roots of their political movement are in contrast to the Palestinians, right? A profound, profound source of weakness for them, because those people who were bribed to come over because of the comforts, right? The lazy people who don't want to, like, who want a free house, who want a free existence, right? Like, who come over from, who make Aliyah, whatever, right? Who choose to colonize Palestine, help in its colonization. You think they're going to stick it out when there's, like, rations and shit? You think they're going to, like, you think they're not going to leave? And you think there's not going to be a mass exodus of people if there was real shit that went down? Like, this is the thing about the strange kind of historical paradox. I want to say irony. I don't know how we can call it, but, like, Zionism's strength is its weakness. Its reliance upon the outside world, upon a kind of military equation that's helped by imperialists, because the imperialists ultimately are on their side, obviously, ultimately, and also from the beginning too, right? Because we know that it's this outpost of Western imperialism in this important geopolitical region, right? That has this overlay of religious importance. But we know that, like, the same thing could also be said about Qatar. The same thing could also be said about Saudi Arabia, about Bahrain, right? Like, these are countries invented by imperialism to ensure that this geostrategic region of the world, full of energy resources, filled with, you know, troublesome populations, if you want to call it that, people who don't necessarily want to become part of the sort of world order, sort of capitalist order, whatever, mm-hmm. like, that's rendered and controlled and dominated by the West. Like, this is where they live, and this is where this important region has become sort of part of this, you know, world of politics for over a century now, right? Since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. I try to say this, like, it's on the Zionists to do this. Like, it's hard to do that. They're working uphill to colonize, right? Colonization is mm-hmm. difficult. Like, historically, to achieve and to sustain and to be victorious, it's actually hard. Now, like, we could talk to the indigenous peoples of Canada, of the US, and see how they feel about that statement. But I think ultimately is that when the numbers and the historical force and the nature of that occupation and the colonization is so obviously sort of nakedly colonial and nakedly, like, open to any kind of whatever political force comes in who can, like, be the most cruel, which seems to be the case of Zionism, where they replace one of their leaders with an increasingly more crueler leader. And that seems to be what seems to be the case.
It's the cruelty really Olympics. Project,
yeah, like, and it's generation after generation, right? Honestly. That becomes more brutalized. But that's a reaction to their faltering power and the increasing power of their enemies, the people they colonize, right? And so, like, I agree. I mean, I think we've come full circle to the beginning of this. I was like, oh, it's depressing now. It's worse than the 80s. But, like,
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, because the military situation has radically changed. And on top of that,
it's not the simple fact that, you know, Palestinians are more capable of defending themselves, but it's also the fact that even if Israel had the worst, most brutal weapons in the world, it now realizes that's not what's going to get it to victory. You know, I do believe, you know, you were talking about how difficult it, you know, the difficulty of colonization, how labor intensive it is, and how really it is such a difficult pursuit. And I wrote this on Twitter the other day, but I truly am constantly astounded what kind of, like, ideological torture and rot does a settler need to have to, like, move halfway across the world to land that is not theirs and never was and never will be, and try to forcibly take it from its rightful owners. I mean, something you have to be so ideologically convinced by this act of theft that you honestly and truly, like, you're a true believer. It's like an honest labor of love that you believe that it is yours and that you, you know, you have a claim over it. But it's really, I think that it's, I think what you said was very astute about how Palestinians are not only crucial for the material land that Israel wants to steal from them, but the any form of Israeli political identity is completely built around a Palestinian one. It's the fact that Palestinians provide not only the materials for Israel to steal, but also the blueprint of what the ultimate Israeli image or in the Israeli or Zionist public imagination is. They want to be Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, you want to be like you're colonized, and yet you resent them so profoundly. I mean, this has to be a kind of spiritual ailment for Zionism. And it's also like, you know what you are in the end. Like, you can't hide your own colonial history because it's so obviously naked. Like, you look at yourself like, oh, is this who we are? Like, we're just like a bunch of people, like, who colonized this land and stole it from people who, like, you know, who lived here for centuries and millennia. Like, that's what we did. Like, you're like, how long can you live under the delusion that that's a good thing? Right now, again, let's ask the indigenous people of North America how they feel about that question. And let's ask how, like, you know, like, how a white MAGA chud in the middle of fucking Tennessee, how he feels about all these questions. Like, and we might get an interesting answer, but like, How long do you think that person's political project would go if it requires some kind of like unity or whatever, right? Not very long. And that's why like America always needs to up the ante, the same way that Israel does. Like, it only needs to up the ante of cruelty, of dispossession, of, you know, class violence in every election cycle. It gets worse and worse, to which one day and to the detriment of their own continent, their own industries, right? Like, eventually America will undo itself. You wonder about the same thing with Zionism, that like in creating, in refusing, like you wonder if Oslo turned out to be something that it wasn't. Like, let's say Oslo actually became something that, you know, resulted in this two-state whatever, where you had, you know, flights every day between Gaza and occupied West and non-occupied West Bank, where all the settlements were gone. Like, what would that have looked like? Would we be here? I think I want to say no. Like, I think that, like, we wouldn't be in this position. But, like, Israel made this situation. They could have, I think, kicked the can of colonization down the road more so than they actually, and it would have been in their interest to do so by giving up those things that clearly its ideological project can't give up, right? Which are, you know, the Hebrons, the whatever. What's the big one in Hebron? I forget. In Khalia, Al-Khalia, the big settlements, I forget. But like, if they had given it up, like, what would the Palestinian life look like today? Would it be kind of like nominally free? I mean, still occupied Palestine, but
I mean,
I guess the right of return is the question, which they'll never accept.
Which is, I think, the central, it's like the nucleus of the Palestinian question. The Nakba, right, and the right of return is really the essence of what liberation means. And I think the two-state solution was always dead on arrival. I don't think it was ever meant for anything other than as an enzyme to the charade of the peace process as Israel encroached on more land. And it was also, you know, the PA was, I mean, the PA is powerful through its Israeli support. I mean, the PA could not really have the kind of iron fist on its dissenters if it wasn't backed by the Israelis. And it's a very convenient partner for the Israelis to have, because Israel wants Palestinians to have the illusion and allure of autonomy and representation, and even the responsibilities of sovereignty. Like, you know, we saw this during COVID, but like providing healthcare for Palestinians. And these are all the responsibilities of the occupier, but Israel, you know, is happy to have a Bantustan ruler to take on these responsibilities and to provide these resources over the occupied. And it also provides, you know, this a scapegoat for the Israelis to continue to say that, you know, there is like a representation to negotiate with. But I think ultimately, it, you know, and we're seeing this perhaps in the aftermath of the death of Nizar Banat, the PA is really hitting a wall. And there are, I cannot predict what would happen, but either Mahmoud Abbas would be replaced by a like-minded figure with just a fresher, younger face of the traitorous collaborationist regime, or it's dismantled altogether. And I really wonder to which end we are driving now.
Tamara, that I've kept you for over an hour. Thank you. I was thinking maybe we could read the will of Basal al-Araj.
Sure.
And the one you translated, and I'll link to it. Just, I think that'll be a nice way to close things out.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much, Sina. It was good to talk to you. I'll read Basil's will, which was found among his possessions in the shelter where he was killed by Israeli occupation forces in collaboration with the Palestinian Authority. He wrote this in Arabic, of course, but I'll be reading it in English. Greetings of Arabism, the homeland and liberation. If you are reading this, then I have died and my soul has ascended to its creator. I pray to God that I meet him with a sound heart, with total sincerity, without an iota of hypocrisy. It is hard to write one's own will. I have read for many years the wills of martyrs and have always been puzzled by them. Quick, brief, short on eloquence and without satisfying our search for answers to our questions about martyrdom. I am now on the path to my fate, satisfied and convinced that I have found my answers. How foolish I was. Is there anything more eloquent than the martyr's act? I was supposed to write this months ago, but what kept me from doing so was your questions, you, the living. Why should I answer you? Look for yourselves. As for us, the people of the graves, we are only looking for the mercy of God.